everyone. Welcome to A to EZ. This episode, we're going to be looking at pneumonia, specifically typical community-acquired pneumonia. What does that mean? Well, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about who gets it, and we're going to talk about the key investigations and management that you need to know. But first, welcome to Yvonne.
Hello, everyone. This is Yvonne. Nice to speak to you once more. But Sally, what do you mean? I thought pneumonia was pretty much the same as saying a chest infection.
That's a good point. And actually, that is probably the best way to describe pneumonia to the patient, as a chest infection. The word pneumonia itself is a blanket term. Like, literally, it means inflammation of the lungs. And that can have loads and loads of different causes. 85% of pneumonia is caused by a bacterial infection. However, it could also be caused by a virus, fungi, or a combination. For example, someone can have a viral pneumonia to start with, a viral chest infection, like COVID or influenza, and then that can get superimposed by a bacteria, such as Staph aureus. But don't worry about that. We're going to be today talking about the most prevalent of all, typical community-acquired pneumonia.
So pneumonia just means lung inflammation and is usually caused by a bacterial infection. But today we're looking at
typical community acquired pneumonia. Yep. So this is the most common type of pneumonia, and it's also specifically listed in SOFIA, which is why we're looking at it today. And it's a pneumonia caused by bacteria, because pneumonia is most commonly caused by bacteria. The word typical means that these are common, specific bacteria that all present in a similar way. And the word community just means the patient has contracted it in the community versus in a hospital, which we would refer to as a hospital-acquired pneumonia, which means it presents 48 hours after someone has been admitted to hospital.
So it's acquired in the community and typically means common bacteria. But what are the common bacteria for it?
So the most common bacteria that we're thinking of are Streptococcus pneumoniae and Haemophilus influenzae. This is a bacteria, by the way, not a virus, although influenza is caused by the influenza virus. Bit confusing, but remember, the two most common bacteria are Streptococcus pneumoniae and Haemophilus influenzae.
So Streptococcus pneumonia and Haemophilus influenza. So what about atypical bacteria?
Good question. So the atypical bacteria that cause community-acquired pneumonia are Mycoplasma, Legionella, and Chlamydia. They're still common, but they're called atypical because they have a less specific presentation. Because the presentation is different and their management is different, we're going to save the atypicals for another episode. So today we're just focusing on typical community-acquired pneumonia, which is caused by Streptococcus pneumoniae or Haemophilus influenzae.
Do we need to know anything else about these two bacteria?
So for PATH in fifth year, yes, you will, but you don't need to worry about that now. In terms of general medicine, not really. Like, the lab will test for these if you send them a sputum sample. But we'll talk more about that later. First of all, let's talk about how a patient with typical community-acquired pneumonia might present.
So who gets pneumonia?
Well, short answer, anybody. It's super common, and that's why it's really important to know about. People more at risk are the elderly, people who are immunosuppressed, or people with structural lung disease.
What do you mean by structural lung disease?
Oh, no, good question. So I guess I'm referring to anyone who has a condition that has changed the soft tissue infrastructure of their lung spaces. So someone who's got emphysema, where the lining of the alveoli is damaged, or maybe someone who's got bronchiectasis, such as a patient with cystic fibrosis, where the airways are scarred and dilated. It's actually really similar to what we said in our septic arthritis episode, if you've listened to that. Basically, a pre-existing disease that damages the infrastructure of anything, whether that's a joint space or lung tissues, it just makes it easier for bacteria to colonize it.
Okay, so bacteria make it past all of the immune barriers we learned about in second year, mucus clearance, etc., and they colonize. And we know that the most common bacteria are Strep and Haemophilus. So how does a patient actually present?
Well, let's break this down. We're going to talk about the three most common symptoms, and then we're going to talk about the three most common signs for our typical community-acquired pneumonia. Three most common symptoms are Fever, it's an infective process. That one's fairly obvious. Cough, again, fairly obvious. We're looking for a productive cough, which differentiates this from a viral cause of pneumonia. And lastly, we're thinking chest pain on breathing in and coughing, and that's a pleuritic chest pain, which Harry's talked about in one of his episodes.
Okay, so we have fever, cough, which is dangerous these days, and chest pain.
Yeah, great. Now, signs-wise, on examination, just going to think about the main three again. Number one is pyrexia. I know this is a bit of a cheat. It's the same thing as fever, but the thing is that patients may not come in and say, I have a fever or I feel feverish. They may not be able to literally tell you that that is what they're feeling. Therefore, it also becomes a sign. You need to check the temperature. If it's raised, it's pyrexia. The second common sign we're looking for in our examination is focal crackles on auscultation. And then thirdly, if it's a severe pneumonia and you've got some dense consolidation in your alveoli, you can also get bronchial breathing.
Okay, so I understand fever / pyrexia, and the focal crackles also make sense too. The infection is causing an inflammatory exudate in the alveoli, so you get the crackles when you listen to the chest. However, what do you mean by bronchial breathing?
Yeah, I had to look this up actually, because in third year, I swear I just wrote learn bronchial breathing and I never really understood what it meant. So I'm going to break it down for you now. I'm going to impart my post-third year knowledge. In healthy lungs, you should hear bronchial breathing over the trachea and you should hear vesicular breathing over the alveoli. So I've put a link to a YouTube video with these breath sounds in it in the description of this podcast for everyone. I did spend a little while like trying to mimic these noises and wondering if I could get away with it on the podcast itself, decided that wasn't wise. So if you want to hear them, there's a little link in the podcast description for you. In short, bronchial breathing, which we hear over the trachea and technically over the bronchi, is a higher pitch, louder sound, and you have this sound on inspiration and expiration with a break in between. That's bronchial breathing. Vesicular breathing, which we hear over the alveoli, so generally over the lung fields, it's lower pitched and it's softer. You also don't get that break in between inspiration and expiration. It's a continuous sound. And it's because in healthy lungs, your trachea and your bronchi are much more rigid than the soft tissues of the alveoli. Like, we know this, that's GCSE. And therefore, it does make sense, because if you have consolidation in the alveoli, if you have your inflammatory exudate filling the alveoli, you're going to lose the elasticity of the alveoli, and therefore the forces at play suddenly become much more like those in the trachea and the bronchi than they are in healthy alveoli. Therefore, your breath sounds become much more similar to bronchial than they do to vesicular, and that's why you get bronchial breathing in consolidation, such as that caused by typical community-acquired pneumonia.
Okay, so bronchial breathing is higher pitch, louder, with a break between inspiration and expiration.
Yeah, exactly right. And you'll hear that pathologically over an area of alveoli, over a lung field, if you've got pathological consolidation.
Okay, got it. So I've taken a history and examined them. What do I do next?
Investigations, as always. So our aims are investigations in terms of typical community-acquired pneumonia, actually twofold, because first of all, obviously you want to confirm your suspected diagnosis that it's a typical community-acquired pneumonia, but also we want to know how bad this pneumonia is, and there is a really helpful and really useful scoring system for that, CURB 65. It's a predictor of the mortality from pneumonia, so that's why we do it, because it guides our management approach. It's a little bit complicated to go through, like talking about it. Again, we've got a lovely link in the description, so you can look at the chart for this as we go through it. But basically, CURB 65 stands for confusion, urea, respirate, blood pressure, and age 65. And that's what we need to make sure we're covering in our investigations.
Okay, so confusion, urea, respirate, blood pressure, and age of 65. And do we need to know the values for this scoring system?
Yes, we do, because we definitely had a question in our third year writtens which relied upon you being able to calculate the score in order to pick the right management plan. So yes, I'm going to say that you do need to know the actual values for this, like for life, 100%, but yes, also for third year exams. So I'll go through the values now. Listen up. But again, remember there's that link in the description. So, you know, if you miss this, you can rewind and listen again. But definitely have a look at the diagram too. Confusion, the C, is less than 8 on an AMTS. That's 1 point. Urea is 8 or more. That would give you another point. Respirate is anything over 30. That's another point. Blood pressure, if the systolic is under 90 or the diastolic is under 60. And then the 65 is just any age over 65. You know, when I was trying to learn this, I found it quite useful to remember that in terms of respirate, which is over 30, blood pressure, which is under 90 or under 60, they're all multiples of 30, so that kind of ties those ones together. And in your first two, your AMTS is less than 8, urea is 8 or more. Again, there's some little tricks that you can learn to remember it. I would really recommend setting aside half an hour to memorize this early on in the year, because you will see lots of typical community-acquired pneumonia in hospitals, and therefore you can apply it on wards and it will stick. So yeah, I would say if you're going to take away one thing from this podcast, the CURB 65 score is used to predict mortality from a community-acquired pneumonia. You do need to know the values and you do need to be able to apply it to a case.
Okay, so do commit the CURB 65 to long-term memory. CURB 65, long-term memory. Okay, got it.
Great. Okay, so back to what this means for our actual investigations that we need to do. Well, we've talked about this before, but when we describe investigations in an OSCE-style situation or to your consultant on a ward round, always categorize them into what you would do in a realistic way. What would you do first? What would you do second? So we've said that we're going to do a history and examination. Our history, we need to include the age and we need to include the AMTS for confusion, right? As well as our usual history of presenting complaint, past medical history, etc., etc. That's the history.
Okay, that's because confusion is the C in CURB 65.
Exactly, yep. So AMTS is in part of your history for this one. Now, moving on to our bedside test. So we're going to do a basic set of observations as we would do for any patient. But in terms of basic observations, we're very interested in the temperature because, as we said, pyrexia is a key sign. And we're also very, very interested in the blood pressure and the respirate because, again, that helps us score our CURB 65.
Last but not least, definitely not least, we're going to be looking out at those oxygen saturations. So just to recap, in terms of observations, very interested in temperature, blood pressure and respirate for the CURB 65 and oxygen saturations.
Also at the bedside, you can do sputum collection and culture. This is really important for our differentiator because obviously if we get some of our atypical organisms, as I said, that's a different management process.
Now most of our bacteria will be picked up on a gram stain of the sputum. But if the patient has any risk factors for TB, which is a high proportion of patients who live in London, we also need to be requesting an acid fast bacilli stain too. On top of that, we also need to remember to request for viral PCR because viruses such as influenza, as we've discussed, also cause pneumonia. So that sputum is really, really helpful. It's not an investigation to be missed.
Thirdly, for a bonus point at the bedside, you can actually do a urine antigen test for Streptococcus pneumoniae and for Legionella, which again was one of those atypical causes we said about. It's actually really, really helpful because that comes back much more quickly than any sputum culture or blood culture that you're going to do. So if you can remember that two of the causes, Streptococcus pneumoniae and Legionella, have urine antigen tests, that's a really, really good thing to remember. Okay, so we've talked about bedside tests, observations, sputum collection, and urine antigen tests. Moving on to bloods, I'm sure you all know this by now, but you would definitely do a full blood count, looking at white cell count, and you would definitely do a CRP because this, in an infective cause, would be raised. And it's also really good to monitor long-term in terms of management because if your CRP is not going down, they're not on the right treatment. We would also need to check urea and electrolytes because this is important for our prognosis again because U in CURB 65 stands for urea.
Okay, so to summarize, we have bedside test, so where we take the temperature and the blood pressure. We have the sputum collection and culture. We have the urine antigen tests, and then we go on to our bloods where we look for white cell count, CRP, and eosinophils.
Yeah, exactly. Full marks. Oh, wait, I think you forgot respirate in OBS, but full marks anyway, because you're my friend, so that's fine.
Thank you very much. We said that for CURB 65, but yeah, I should have mentioned. Anyhow, so we did all of these. What about imaging?
Okay, so this is probably very predictable, but we would get a chest x-ray. And I know it's predictable, but it is the definitive thing that's going to help us differentiate between other causes of our signs and symptoms. So again, guys, if you've got data at the moment, look in the description of this podcast because we've got a nice link to an example x-ray of a lobar pneumonia. So if you have a pneumonia, the consolidation is usually concentrated in one lobe of the lung. You would have to be extremely immunosuppressed to get multilobar pneumonia. In that lobe where you've got the consolidation, or in other terms you might say alveolar opacification, you would also see things called air bronchograms.
Okay, I'm sure a lot of people will have this question, but what are air bronchograms?
Yeah, no, again, this is just something I learned for third year and never actually questioned what they might look like. You should be able to see this in the Radiopedia article we've linked below, guys. But air bronchogram simply refers to when you can see the air-filled bronchi, which you usually can't see, because the surrounding alveoli are white because they have a pacification from the consolidation. That's simply it. You can see the bronchi because the surrounding alveoli are suddenly white because they are full of inflammatory exudate. But yeah, back to why chest x-rays are so key. Just to run through a few of like the top differentials that you might have in your head when someone comes in with a pneumonia picture. An exacerbation of COPD, for example, could also give you a cough, which could confuse your symptoms in some ways. But if we think about the chest x-ray, they won't have any alveolar consolidation in someone with COPD. The most likely thing you'd see with a patient with simple COPD is a hyperinflated chest, but no consolidation in the lung fields. Meanwhile, thinking about our signs, any kind of consolidation in the lungs could give you some vocal crackles. It could give you maybe a little bit of bronchial breathing if it's severe. And other causes of consolidation include pulmonary edema or a space-occupying lesion like a tumour. But when we get to the chest x-ray, they look quite different. We said that a pneumonia is lobar and you have air bronchograms. Well, a tumour, it's going to be well circumscribed. It's not going to fill our entire lobe and you don't get the air bronchograms. Also, if it's lung metastases, there are going to be multiple consolidations scattered across the lung fields. Meanwhile, with something like pulmonary edema caused by heart failure, that's fluid in the alveoli. So you will get the alveoli pacification and you can get air bronchograms in this. But with pulmonary edema, it's bilateral and widespread. Again, not just concentrated in one lobe.
Okay, so we've been through quite a lot of information here. I will just summarize that we get a lobar opacification with air bronchograms in pneumonia, whereas in differentials like COPD, you'll have hyperinflation. In tumor, you'll be more well-differentiated, well-circumcised, no bronchograms, and pulmonary edema will be bilateral, more widespread consolidation, although you could also have air bronchograms.
Yes, exactly. That's really, yeah. Great summary. Thanks, Yvonne.
Okay.
As I say, I feel like if you guys are able to look through these images yourselves, it should all be a bit clearer, but they are the main differentiators. Okay, guys, we're finally on to management. We're going to keep it fairly brief now. Essentially, you want to give this person antibiotics, and this is again where our Curve 65 comes into play. If we remember, Curve 65, it's got 5 elements, so you've got a maximum of 5 points. If the patient scores a 1 or a 0, they are probably safe to be managed in the community. If they score a 2, so they're confused and their urea is a little bit high, or they're over 65 and their respirate is above 30, then you would probably consider admitting them into hospital. And if they score a 3 or above, that's really serious and they're probably going to need ITU involvement. So that kind of stages where your patient will be when they receive the management, and also helps us decide what type of management they're going to get, whether oral or IV antibiotics. However, it's not the only thing to consider. I know we've stated that the Curve 65 is important, and it really is, but this needs to be put into the clinical picture of the patient. If the patient has a lot of comorbidities, they are also more likely to need admission, regardless of their Curve 65 score. And another thing, which you may remember we picked up on in the OBS, oxygen saturations, also really important to consider when you're thinking about admitting a patient, because they may have a good Curve 65 score, but actually their oxygen stats aren't hitting that magic 94, and therefore they're going to need supplemental oxygen, therefore they're going to need admission either way. Going back to what we said about antibiotics, however, so the general rule we're thinking of for typical community-acquired pneumonia is a penicillin plus minus a macrolide. However, again, we're not going to go into too much detail, because what you'd actually do in reality is definitely ask the patient about antibiotic allergies. That's number one. But number two, that magic phrase, I would consult local guidelines for antibiotic prescription for typical community-acquired pneumonia by this causative organism.
That's such a classic thing to say about antibiotics, that you would look at the local guidelines of the hospital. Anyhow, so we have our management, which depends on CURB 65. Anything that's 1 or 0 can be managed in the community, so you just give them, prescribe them antibiotics. 2, you admit, and 3, would probably need ITU involvement. And then you always consult the local guidelines for antibiotics. Got it. So in terms of prognosis, is this something we should worry about?
Yes, we should definitely be thinking about prognosis. I would describe it as depending on two things in typical community-acquired pneumonia. First of all, the presentation of the patient, and secondly, their response to therapy. Firstly, the presentation. We've talked about this. We've talked about the CURB 65, a high score means a higher mortality risk. We've talked about oxygen requirement being important to consider. And I suppose overarching all of those, you also need to keep in your head, like, is this patient septic when they arrive? Have they already got organ dysfunction from their infection? You know, is their blood pressure low? Is their heart rate high? Was sepsis 6 needed upon initial assessment of the patient? Those kind of things predict prognosis in a pneumonia patient. The second thing to think about is response to the antibiotics given.
Okay, so generally positive news. Hopefully, if it's a typical pneumonia that the patient responds well to the antibiotics, you'll have an improvement within 3 days. However, we should consider special groups of people like COPD with further follow-up. Okay, and now, hot topic, vaccines. Is there a vaccine for pneumonias?
Yes, there is, and it's a really, really good thing to know about. It's offered on the NHS to people over 65 or anyone with a long-term medical condition. It's specifically against Streptococcus pneumoniae, so it's the pneumococcus vaccine, and it lasts 5 to 10 years, so the patient doesn't even need to get it every year. They can just go once when they're 65 and they'll be protected at least until they're 70. It's actually colloquially referred to as the old man's friend, because as CURB 65 tells us, this is a really, really dangerous infection for the elderly in particular in terms of mortality. So to be able to know about this vaccine and to recommend it to patients and ensure that patients over 65 have had it is a really good thing for us to do as future doctors.
Very interesting. So there is a vaccine for people over 65. However, my dad is 62. I think if I called my dad an old man, he would be very offended. So I'm not sure about...
Hey guys, it's Harry with your 30-second summary. So, typical community-acquired pneumonia is an infection of the alveoli and is usually caused by Streptococcus pneumoniae or Haemophilus influenzae. At-risk groups include the elderly, immunosuppressed, and those with pre-existing respiratory disease. Key signs on examination are pyrexia, focal crackles, and localized bronchial breathing. The CURB 65 score is a predictor of 30-day mortality and stands for confusion, urea, respirate, blood pressure, and age over 65. Management is guided by the score and is specific to local trust guidelines. Remember to check that all patients over 65 had the pneumococcal vaccine. Thanks for listening.